And now we present to you Thacko with Advantage.
Welcome to Thacko with Advantage. We're two friends that have been playing D&D a long time. While we both love lots of other RPGs, D&D designers have been going off and exploring when we weren't looking.
Hi, I'm Chris and not Ange. Wow, weird. I've also been gaming for over 3 decades, just like she has. I started, though, with 2nd edition and haven't really stopped since. And I've been editing and writing and podcasting for many, many, many years now. Thank you for having me, Jared.
And I'm Jared, author of many articles at Gnomes Do and WhatDoIKnowJR.com. I got to learn D&D on the ground floor of the Satanic Panic, and I've been playing long enough to see another one flare up.
Wow, that's a long time, Jared. do you need me to get you your cane? Do you not want some arthritis medicine? have you recently signed up for your most current colonoscopy to make sure that you don't have problems there?
Yeah, that last one's not a joke, man.
I know. I just had my first one. Talking about old, not a joke. Now that we're done with enough of the potty humor, what are we talking about today, buddy?
Well, after we look at the games that we're running in the campaign journal, we'll be talking about the roller coaster ride that is the RPG industry right now. I mean, literally as of today. Then we'll have some recommendations of D&D related content for you to check out in our downtime research segment.
Now, podcasting is not a linear system. And while we are talking about events that are occurring today, you will hear about them later.
Now, stand by for station identification. This is WDND The Role Player. Now we're going to McElroy McKinney and the Bardic College.
In 1985, Unearthed Arcana introduced the idea of a zero-level player character. This is only a mechanic for Cavaliers. As a punishment for not being upper class on the social class chart, you had to earn your way to first level 1d4 hit points at a time. Zero level was revisited in the 1986 adventure Treasure Hunt, where a character started with 1d6 hit points and a secondary skill, and when they used a proficiency or class ability 3 times in different encounters, they learned that ability. If you learned something allowed only to certain classes, you had to pick one of those classes when you leveled up at the end of the adventure. Because that was way too easy to understand, 1988's Greyhawk Adventures introduced a zero-level system where you start with aptitude points and you could only spend so many aptitude points a week. But you had to save aptitude points to spend along with your training points to learn class abilities. That's not convoluted at all. At least you didn't have to earn your aptitude points by filling in ovals for a Scantron machine that told you what you could spend your training points on.
Let me just finish up this campaign journal.
Jared, I play a lot of games.
Uh-huh.
I don't really play a ton of Dungeons & Dragons, only with you and Ange, and only the Heroes of Hobble's Way, which if I talked about, it would be super spoilers.
That is true. We can't let people hear that.
No, there have been elemental stuff things going on. There have been split mud people going on. There have been other champions arising. There may have been some playing around with illicit substances for enlightenment by certain characters. A lot of exercise by other characters. Boy, flip those things around in your head because they're not what you think they are. That is my vague campaign journal about the Heroes of Hobble's mm-hmm. Way. Did I do a good job? I think I did a good job.
Yeah, I think that touched on a lot of the points there.
In other news, I've been playing my Master Nyarlathotep campaign. That's totally Call of Cthulhu, which doesn't count at all for this show. I don't even think it counts as other fantasy gaming, right? I'm way off in left field. But we're 20 sessions into it. And boy, did that campaign not follow anything of that the book. I mean, I'm it's a 950 page campaign, all the material. And they're in Australia now. They're doing Australia things, which I'm sort of using the Australia chapter as a rough outline for what they should be doing after they've destroyed everything that has occurred before that. Also, none of the characters that started the campaign are the characters that exist right now in the campaign. It was real hilarious when 2 characters were looking for the original party and couldn't find them, and they just ran into some of the replacements of the party. That was a really fun role-playing exercise, let me tell you. Okay, that's all I got.
I don't know if I have ever heard someone say they have finished that campaign.
Well, I will. We should be done in about 4 or 5 sessions.
That I will have to mark that down, because I don't think I've heard that from anyone that I actually know.
The only other person I know of that's ever finished Master Nyarlathotep, which, by the way, if you're listening to this and you finished Master Nyarlathotep, let us know. We would like to hear from you. Yes. Come to our Discord, come to our Patreon, leave a message. Those are the best ways to find us. The Discord's free. The Patreon, you can sign up for free, hang out there to get to our Discord, all that good stuff. But the only other person I've ever heard that finished it was XP Love Cat on YouTube. She has a YouTube channel. She finished it because she did a bunch of videos giving tips and tricks for all the different countries that you go to.
So I have my Curse of Strahd game happening this weekend, and I may have sent out some offers from the Dark Powers to various player characters that have been doing things that may have been, you know, getting the attention of the Dark Powers, and I might have had a few of them get back to me about what they're going to do with those temptations. So this could be interesting. I am a person who does not normally like a lot of secrets in their game, especially if they potentially blow up in people's faces. So I did send out a thing saying, I do not want this to turn into player versus player. If, you know, if you do really want that vibe, talk to the person and make sure that it's a thing that you're both into. The other thing that I said is, you can tell anybody you want to. You can tell people out of character so that you know the other players know, but their characters don't know. You could have your person confess to the other, you know, players that they've been dabbling with this stuff. It's up to you. I'm just saying this is your secret to decide one way or the other.
See, that I think that's very responsible of you, and very responsible of you to let your players, like, give them those options and those things and be like, these are the expectations that I have. That's how you handle that stuff, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Like, it's the most positive way that you can handle it. Because the other way, I mean, you could do that. You could just keep secrets from people. That's like playing with knives.
Mm-hmm.
And being small children playing with knives. People get their feelings hurt by stuff like that. I know it's just a game and stuff, but man, nobody likes to be deceived.
Oh, yeah. And I did also tell the entire group, some of you are getting tempted by the Dark Powers. And if that comes up and somebody tells you that, that's fine. But I'm just letting everyone know that is the thing that's now in play in the campaign.
Good usage of communication, right? Like, put it out there, let people know what's up, give them options, tell them what you expect. Good tool set. Yeah.
And especially since, I mean, it's weird thinking that this is a new group because we've been playing this now for like a year or so, but it is something like this is their first D&D campaign for a lot of them. And I don't want them to get that idea that, like, some of these old school thoughts of, like, you keep the secret and if somebody finds out about it, then you have to murder their characters. Yeah, I don't want them having some of these old things ingrained in them. Like, we are telling a collaborative story. Just figure out how you want to tell it.
It's actually easier, in my opinion, when you have a bunch of adults that are reasonable human beings, and I'm just mean like averagely reasonable human beings that have never played the game before because they don't have any preconceived notions.
Mm-hmm.
So they're more willing to just accept the thing that you often tell them and be like, this is why, especially when you give them reasoning, because there's nothing for them to have friction against it.
I don't know that I would have done this, except that I have one person who's never played D&D before this campaign, but she is very much a fan of Critical Role, and she loves the whole, like, Matt dismissing everyone except for one person. And so I kind of wanted to explain, like, this is why I don't do it exactly like that, but I get that you kind of like that vibe, so this is what we're going to be doing, you know, that sort of thing.
We also have no idea what goes on behind the scenes on shows like
that. Yeah, I was going to say, there was, I forget, at one point in time, somebody asked Brendan Lee Mulligan about, like, safety tools, and he says, we use them on set, it's just that sometimes, if we did have to use them, we're not going to, you know, that's something that's going to get edited out anyway.
Yep, because that could be useful to an audience, but that show in particular is there for entertainment purposes. The inclusion of safety tools into an episode like that wouldn't be about entertainment, that would be about education.
Yeah. It's a very special episode of Dimension 20.
Right? Thank you, Jared. That's exactly what that would be.
I did run my other game, which is the 2014 Midgard game. Our group was dealing with the horrible Forge Master, and he became a Death Knight. They needed to find out what sin he committed that they could expunge from the region so that he could finally not come back every 24 hours if he's destroyed. And apparently, I Baldur's Gate 3'd my people, because on the map there was clearly a door, but there was kind of an outcropping and nobody noticed it there. And I say Baldur's Gate 3 because there are so many times I have stood right next to a door and thought, where is the door at? There's no way out of this place.
That's funny. I like that.
They ended up finding out that the black mithril that they ran into actually is the void bound souls of people that upset the Forge Master. So he turned them into living armor, or undead armor, basically.
Jared, you're a monster.
I am. look at all this mithril. Yeah. Look at all this mithril. but I had, like, the ghost of the apprentice that, you know, first rose up against him, showed up, and explain to them that there's this ritual they can do if they wanted to actually free all the people from this armor. They didn't have to, but apparently they decided they didn't want to be terrible, monstrous people that just let souls get trapped in armor for all eternity. So there are three components to it. And one of them was understanding this equation that would help bleed off the void energies. The other one was a song against the void that would push it back. And the third one was a wisdom insight check to see which of the souls were the most agitated so that they could go around and calm them. I did kind of pick these to make sure that my players had applicable skills and not just, you know, picking random skills that nobody in the party had. I was using a version of the A Life Well Lived, you know, the things that Cubicle 7 did where there's like, there's the target number and then however many above the DC they get, you subtract it from the target number until it hits zero. And every time the initiative hits one, because we were keeping track of initiative for this, every time initiative hit one, there was a necromantic surge of energy that went out and damaged everybody. So there was an impetus to actually get this done at a certain point in time.
That mechanic, I like that mechanic a lot because I use it all the time. But mm-hmm. I have my own version of it, and it's hilarious because I wrote like a Gnome Store article about it like a year and a half ago. And I got torn up on the internet, but like that doesn't really work by people that like supposedly know more than I do. I'm like, all right, that's fine. It is fine. Like, I think it's a great idea though. Also, you're not a monster because you gave them like choices and you thought about how they could actually use their skills to apply to this. So I take back what I said. You're not a monster. You just provide monsters for them to deal with.
The funny thing about that too is that mechanic. I have seen like three different people that I respect greatly tinker around with mechanics or write them for a living or whatever, make something similar to that mechanic, not having talked to each other about it.
Yeah, man, I'm not in a vacuum, right? Like, I know that thing exists in a few other places. I'm glad that they put it in a book. I'm glad that Cobalt Press,
yeah,
that people will use it now. Because I think it's a good mechanic, personally.
Oh, yeah. I like it because it does solve some of the issues with just how skill challenges worked in 4th edition and that's a whole other thing to get off on, though, but someday we should probably talk about that.
We should. I would be all about it. The misuse of the 4th edition skill challenge in that book and how people didn't quite grok how it should work because we weren't as indie-centrically educated as we are now.
And the irony of how Planets of Intrigue and Star Wars Saga Edition actually presented the skill challenge better than D&D did.
This is Chris nodding his head yes.
Anyway, they freed the souls, which of course brought the Death Knight to justice because the souls were no longer bound there. Death Knight is no longer going to come back. And because they did this momentous thing, the elven god who was the emperor who founded this empire back centuries ago before humans took over actually showed up to thank all of them. I gave them like the divine gifts where they got like a +2 and a +2 to their cap for the ability score. They could choose one ability score, or they could choose the Boon of Defense, which was like a bonus to armor class and a +1 to all saves just forevermore.
Ooh, that's a big deal right there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And then there's one where it is the last boon was just permanent magic resistance.
That's the part where, like, me and Jared would write in our notes, like, on the margin, make everything one higher because we gave them a +1 bonus to everything. I'm just kidding. We wouldn't do that. I'm just messing around.
Literally, a lot of this stuff is moving towards a confrontation with a really big, nasty dragon, and I don't want them to die. So I would like them to have gifts for them doing something, you know, that's working towards the goal.
I mean, they're 12th level, right?
Oh, yeah, they're 12th level now.
I mean, they're powerful. They got tools. If they die, it's their own faults.
But I just gave him a dragon slaying spear and everything.
If they die, it's definitely their own faults.
But yes, their next move is they have to go recruit a mercenary band who is sworn. The mercenary band is sworn to Loki.
That won't go wrong.
No, especially since we have a Astamar that is descended from Baldur.
There's nothing bad that could potentially happen there. The Norse mythology folks out there, you understand what we're saying. For those who don't, like Loki and Baldur, man, it's too bad. That whole story is so tragically sad.
Depending on what point in time you hear the story, one of them ended up dead because of this.
Yepers.
So that's all that I have for what I'm running, which means we could start talking about our main topic.
Let's do it. On to the Dungeon Master's Workshop.
Welcome to the Dungeon Master's Workshop.
Hey, Jared, did you hear the news today?
Sure, which news?
The news that Chris Perkins and Jeremy Crawford decided to sign on with Darrington Press and become their lead story designer and lead game designer.
Holy crap, look at me doing my Home Alone phase.
Too bad it's a podcast, otherwise it'd be great. You can all imagine it, though. You've all seen Jared's face, right? You've all seen it. It's out there on the internet. Go look it up.
To be fair, when I saw the news come through, I did almost do that. It's just I was at work when I saw it pop up on my phone.
The first thing I did was, is this real? Like, I had to ask the question. I thought that, too.
I thought that, too. This
can't be real, right? Then I thought about it for a second. I'm like, doesn't Crawford's husband live in L.A.? That kind of makes sense. But I thought Perkins was moving to, like, somewhere else. I didn't live. I guess he's going to L.A., too. Whatever. I don't know. Maybe he'll, you know, work remotely. I have no idea, but... I was just blown away. This is wild, right? Like, just straight up wild. The first thing I thought was, aside from the fact that they're getting some pretty exceptional game designers, I really think Chris Perkins is a fantastic story designer.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm running Curse of Strahd right now, which is like one of his babies there.
That thing, I mean, he pretty much wrote the whole first draft by himself. Like, he took like a couple of weeks of vacation and wrote the whole thing. Right. He took a vacation to write a campaign. Just throwing that out there. That's how much this guy loves this stuff. But like, what a coup for Darrington Press, right? What a coup for the Daggerheart people. I wonder what this means for Spencer Stark. Like, does he still work there? I assume he does.
I assume so. I mean, because honestly, when you read through the press release, they mentioned new products and existing products that they're going to be supporting.
Sure. Makes sense.
Which isn't specifically saying they are only designing for Daggerheart, although there's no way they aren't designing for Daggerheart.
Yeah, yeah, right. And I know that this is generally a Dungeons & Dragons show. I've been trying to convince Ange and Jared to move it into a more just fantasy gaming general show, because we would like to talk about things like Dragonbane and Shadowdark and Daggerheart, you know, Drawsteel when it comes out.
Someday I'm going to get my 13th Age second edition because I was stupid and forgot to back it.
Yeah, right. We'll talk about that game, too. We should talk about all those games. I think the fantasy gaming genre is a very varied landscape of games these days. But I don't know. We should talk about, I think, what this means in general, in the short term and potentially the long term in the tabletop gaming landscape. I mean, we've been talking about it a little bit on our Discord with different people, and a lot of people have a lot of various opinions about how they think this will all work. And me and Jared have our own various opinions. I guess the first thing I think I'd like to get into is, what do you think this will do for the Daggerheart game in the next year and then the next like 3 years?
I think there's definitely a wave of people that started playing in like the 2015 on era that were Critical Role fans that also jumped on to the 2014 version of D&D that definitely know who Chris Perkins is, definitely know who Jeremy Crawford is. So those names mean something to them. And I think they have definitely, if those people weren't already going to check out Daggerheart, I think they have guaranteed that they are going to check out Daggerheart in some way, shape or form at this point.
I agree with that on my end. I think Crawford's a great designer, but I think Perkins is the real coup here for the Daggerheart folks because of the way that this game is set up, right? This is a game that cares a lot about narrative first, but has a bunch of mechanics inside of it to help tell that story. There's a lot of mechanics to narrative type stuff in the game. So not like we just wibbly-wobbly tell a story, but like actual things that provoke story choices. And I think Perkins is one of the better narrative designers of gaming in the past 20 years. Like just the stuff that he worked on, especially if you look at some of the things that he worked on when he was the editor for Dragon Magazine, he did a lot to like make third edition adventures feel like real complete and comprehensive stories. And I think we're about to get a lot of that coming back around for how he interacts with Daggerheart, because he had a little less oversight when he was the editor in chief at Dragon Magazine or at Dungeon Magazine. Sorry. So, I mean, Daggerheart is not exactly got a bunch of like C-suite people overseeing it to be like, you got to do this, this, and this. So what do you get when you have Chris Perkins with the essentially the shackles off his wrists, right? Like, that's what I think we're about to get.
I was going to say, for CEOs, you have to talk Travis Willingham and Sam Riegel.
Yeah, those two jokes. I mean, they're smart business people too, right? Yeah. But they're also, I mean, if you've ever watched, just go watch the first 10 minutes of a Critical Role episode, and you can see what kind of a ridiculous human being Sam Riegel is.
More to the point, though, is like you were saying, it's not that we aren't going to be business savvy. It's that they understand that they are making games and entertaining people. They don't just own a brand underneath something else.
Yeah, I mean, they're actors first, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's where they're going to really thrive. And look, man, Crawford's got chops too, right? Like, I'm not downplaying Crawford here, but man, Crawford's got game too. And if you think, well, this leads into my next thing. When it comes to like most well-known or famous game masters in the world, Perkins and Crawford are on the list because they ran the stuff. Yeah. They ran the stuff for Acquisitions Incorporated. Like, mm-hmm. I went and saw in a movie theater, Chris Perkins run a game via Fathom Events, running it for Acquisitions Incorporated. And after Perkins kind of stopped doing that, Crawford took it over and he did just as good, if not a better job.
What's interesting to me is when you're talking about narrative, but also, you know, using the mechanics, having a mechanically robust way of resolving things, even in a narrative story. I used to listen to Dice Camera Action when it was on, and Chris Perkins kind of ran his game that way. Like, it's not that he ignored the rules, it's that he ignored the rules until he wanted to use them, and then he used them.
Mm-hmm. And I think Daggerheart's got a more comprehensive system for doing that kind of play. That mm-hmm. play style is more akin to what that game can do. And it's no knock on D&D. I mean, I love me some 5th edition D&D. Because it's so flexible, right? Like, that 5th edition rule set's super flexible. Now, notice mm-hmm. I say 5th edition D&D, 5th edition, and I did say D&D. I don't really mean Dungeons & Dragons. Like, we can argue about the 2024 rules, and whether they're good or bad or anything like that, but as Mike Shea from Sly Flourish likes to say, man, we just have this game, and people can do mm-hmm. whatever they want with it. There's so many permutations of it now.
Yeah. This is not one of those things, like, I ran 3.5, and I really thought it was the one, man. I really did, but it wasn't.
It wasn't.
But I did not, looking back, it felt like I was running it forever. I have been running 5th edition longer than I ever ran 3rd edition, and that's even rolling Pathfinder into it.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I really do like 5th edition D&D. I think it's a great mm-hmm. game. The 5th edition rule set's a great rule set. But I've been playing, like, other games all mm-hmm. along anyway, right? Like, I love PBTA stuff, and Daggerheart kind of sits in between those two things. And I think that these two designers will take great advantage of that fact. That it's got that same feel to me that 5e had when it first came out. It's like, oh man, this game is so simple. It's got such a flexible yet simple rule set to like stick stuff on top of, that it can be modified in a bunch of different ways. That's why I'm always so impressed with the rule book that they put together for it, because of those campaign frameworks with the modifications for rules that they have in the back of it to show that and prove it. Not in a Dungeon Master's Guide that's hidden, but in the core book.
Yeah. It's been kind of fascinating to me because I try and follow a fairly wide range of people on social media, which, one, that's not really easy when social media platforms blow up left and right.
They do.
But on top of that, I have people that are very dedicated D&D players that I follow. I have people that are very hardcore indie game players that I follow. And it's interesting to me that on those two extremes, there are people that really can't get their head around Daggerheart because they can't see incorporating those two, which is really funny because most of the people I game with just naturally incorporate those two types of games into them.
Yeah. Depending on your preferred game style, that happens, right? Like, if you only play narrative games where the narrative is the king or queen or monarch, take your pick, then it might be hard for you to like enjoy or get your head around the idea of playing games that have like character classes and the skills and powers, and you have to spend this currency or that. I mean, they shouldn't have a problem with that, but they would just want to tell a story and be like, cool, that's the thing that I choose. Like, did I have to, like, that's my turn. And that's just not how these games work. Or maybe I have to roll some dice and then I get to make a choice after that. And this game sort of works like that, but not really.
Yeah.
And then there's the people on the other end, right? We're talking about your third edition players, your Pathfinder 2 players, which fairly tactical game. Your Draw Steel players, even some of your old, I feel like the OSR players, the old school revival renaissance players, I don't know where they fit because they could be both sides of that, right?
I was going to say, I've seen OSR people that fit a wide range of things that are very hard to put in a box.
Yeah, there ain't no box there. It's just a, they're just using old games to play new games, sort of, maybe kind of, most of the time. But like the super trad players, I suppose, the traditional game players, they also, they're like, this narrative stuff doesn't jive with me because it's not what my, it's not the action economy that I have or the things that I could do on my turn, right? Like, that stuff exists in the game. If you go watch Age of Umbra, like, you could see Matt being like, yeah, I'm going to move it close. I'm going to move far. I got my ruler out. This is how far I can go. I feel, it looks like a lot like a Savage Worlds game to me a lot of times. Yeah. I'm like, oh, man, you got the ruler out. When I ran it, because I've run a session, a couple of when people hear this, I was just guessing. Like, that looks close. That looks far. That looks very close. Like, yeah, I'm just tend to rule in favor of the players. So it works both ways, which is useful.
I think what's been interesting to me is listening to Age of Umbra. Matt is a lot more precise about explaining like those fear spends and everything that he's doing when he's spotlighting his adversaries than I remember him being about calling out D&D mechanics, which is not to say he wasn't using the D&D mechanics, but he wasn't stopping and calling things out quite the same way that he is with this.
I mean,
I don't know if it's just teaching people or if it's just that's more natural in this game.
I think it might just be teaching people.
Yeah.
I mean, I also think he's teaching the players too, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Like, I don't think Ashley Johnson has like learned the game super well yet. Right. Like, and that's nothing. I like listening to Ashley a lot. She's a great player and she's a lot of fun with the voices and the things that she does at the table. But it's pretty obvious that some of these folks have not played a ton of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And while some of the other ones have, like, I'm pretty sure Taliesin's played a bunch of the game. He seems to know the rules really well. I get a feel that Travis knows the rules pretty well too. I mean, he should, right? Like, I'm pretty sure he's part of a lot of the play tests. He's one of the main business partners of it. So, I don't know. It's fun to me to watch that. And I think they did some of that on purpose. They're like, look, don't play this game because we're going to play this game on stream, right? So that we can show what it looks like to learn the game.
Yeah.
That's what I think actually happened. We'll know more, Jared, for sure, when they do another game and we'll see how that runs it.
Yeah, that'll be interesting, especially since we've only got to see 8 of these and then see him what he's going to run next after that, because they are only doing an 8-episode season for this.
They are, which I'm very, very fond of. So, yes, while we are talking about Perkins and Crawford, we are also talking about Daggerheart and the Critical Role folks, because
it's hard not to, because this is all intertwined now.
It is now all intertwined. And Daggerheart is sold out, like, even on Amazon, just gone, right? Like, the pre-orders for July, it looks like, are gone too. So the game's selling, as far as we can tell, really well. We have no idea how many units they sold. We'll never really know, but it seems like it's going pretty well for them, which is, to me, a plus positive for the industry overall. Do you have anything you want to bring up?
For one thing, I'm curious about the deluxe box that they did, because that had an absolutely ridiculous amount of stuff in it, and I cannot see them making that on a profit. I mean, that had like the deluxe gilded cards, and it had the different tokens for tracking fear and hope. It had like the specialized, you know, dice that looked like they were the official dice. I mean, they had the GM screen and everything in there. Super nice box. I mean, the base game looks way too nice for its price point.
That's accurate. I mean, it's a $60 book with 100 cards or so in it, right? 120 cards or something. And it's got a magnetic, I have it. I mean, I could go get it, but I have like, it's got like a magnetic case for the cards, which is way more than it needed.
Yeah. And I think it is fair to point at the thing that WotC did not this last year, but the year before that with the Book of Many Things, because the Book of Many Things was this big thing of, you know, a deck of many things, the extended version of it in its own box with all the gilded cards and a book. And that was $100.
I mean, there's no way they made money off of it.
Yeah.
And there's no way. There probably wasn't that many of them, right? They probably took a bit of a loss on it or broke even. Maybe it was a break even thing, right?
It might be. Yeah.
They might have just sold those at cost.
I think to some extent, though, what I think I'm kind of getting at here is, I don't think they did that because they don't understand how to make money off of it. I think they did that because they wanted to get this out in people's hands.
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, I don't know if anybody remembers the old Fate Core Kickstarter. They were selling that PDF for like $10.
Mm-hmm.
It had like something like 12,000 backers because they were just trying to get that book in people's hands. That wasn't like a moneymaker for them, really. The Dresden Files game was the moneymaker for them.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
It was like a promotional move.
Well, I mean, even like, you know, you mentioned Savage Worlds, like for the longest time, I don't know if this is still the case, but like they always had a soft cover version of their core rules for $10.
Yeah, the Explorer's Guide usually, or whatever their core rules was. It wasn't a very big book. It was a marketing move. Now, Darrington's a bit bigger of a company with they're not just a game company, they're a multimedia company if you include like the Critical Role brand and that media company behind that. Like they have the Vox Machina show on Amazon, which does always really, really well. They're all voice actors in their own right that do other things that make them money. So not that Darrington Press and the Critical Role Media Company is a side hustle for them. It makes them a lot of money too, but they have other avenues of making money is what I'm trying to get at. Maybe it's not a big deal for them to lose a few bucks on getting this game in front of people's hands. And I actually don't think the $60 book loses them money. I think they make profit off of it. I don't think it's the same amount of profit that other people might make it at. But also, any book that they sold from their web store is pure profit.
Yeah, yeah. The Book of Many Things, for example, I don't think WotC printed, like, that's not getting printed in Player's Handbook quantities.
Sure, right? Daggerheart probably is. I'm sure there's...
Yeah.
We don't know what the numbers are, but I'm sure it's tens of thousands. Like, at least 10,000. It was probably a 10,000 book print run at least, right? Like, why would you do it? You couldn't do it affordably for less than that. I'm just glad that they got them done before the tariff stuff went down.
Right? Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know there is some talk of some people being able to get at least books done in the U.S. It's mainly like components and boxes that are going to be like literally impossible to do in the U.S. But that also means that U.S. printers will be jammed up by whoever gets there first to get their orders in.
That's true. There's no infrastructure for that in the United States, really.
No.
That's why a bunch of board game companies closed down. This is a total tangent from what we were talking about, but it's relevant to this idea of the product. Like I said, selling from their storefront makes them just pure profit, right? Sending it out to game stores, like they have to share the money with the game stores, not a big deal. I mean, they probably still make a couple bucks on that sale. Mm-hmm. Selling through Amazon, they also probably still make a couple bucks on that sale. You don't do it for a loss. You try not to do it. I assume they didn't do it for a loss. That would just be silly, but... They probably didn't do it for enough of a margin of profit that would feel profitable without having those direct sales.
Given that the deluxe box was a limited number and they're not going to reprint them, if they did lose anything on the deluxe boxes, that was to have the deluxe boxes out there. And, you know, a lot of people, I would have, if I would have remembered to get my pre-order in on time, I would have gotten a deluxe box and a regular one. So, I mean, it's not like they weren't going to get extra sales out of that. What I'm kind of curious about is for a long time, I have talked with certain friends about this and said that nothing is going to be a D&D killer except Hasbro. Nothing is going to externally come in there and completely eclipse them. But.
Oh, I'm curious as to this, but everything you said, I agree with.
It's the idea of how you have one company now that obviously has some money and a fan base and momentum. And you have another company that has been losing money in a lot of their other divisions and is just pushing a product in order to make money off the product. Not saying there's not quality there. I know some, you know, like some of the designers for D&D, absolutely wonderful people, have done great work. But I am saying that the Hasbro side of things is, we need this to keep being profitable because we don't have that many profitable divisions right now. And that is a completely different paradigm. And I don't know how well the game D&D lasts under that paradigm versus the IP D&D, which is really what Hasbro cares about.
The IP of D&D makes them money regardless, right? So
they'll
still make the game. I don't see why they wouldn't. They're not going to shut it down, I don't think.
Yeah, I'm not really looking at it in terms of shutting it down, just in more in terms of how many resources do we actually allocate for this?
I mean, if we're lucky, they'll get it down to a small team again and lets them do whatever they want. I mean, that would be the great thing. Look, I'm gonna make a comp to a video game company. Let's talk about Blizzard. Let's talk about World of Warcraft. So for the longest time, they just kept trying to like get them to crunch and work really hard with not as much talent and not as much pay because they were Blizzard. And this was a while ago. This is not the case anymore, but you can make more money like at Riot or somewhere like that doing design work than you could at Blizzard, which Blizzard was like for a long time. Blizzard was like the thing. And we might be entering a similar era to that. with Hasbro and the D&D brand compared to some of these other companies that exist. Now, we'll scale it down for this is not the same amount of money. Like, and then for those who are like video game historians or know what's going on in the industry over there, like Microsoft bought Blizzard. They work under that brand, under that umbrella now. They've had a lot of ups and downs. The game has gotten good again, and the game is still considered to be bad. They try to put it on like a release schedule and all that stuff. But like, you know, that's the thing that happens when you have corporate interference, is like you have these ups and downs based on the corporation. Now, you get a lot of indie companies like the people that make Clair Obscura, the Expedition 33 Game of the Year stuff, that are like, well, nobody was bothering us, so we just made the game that we wanted. Same thing with Baldur's Gate 3. Nobody bothered us for seven years, so we made the best game we could.
Absolutely. I mean, people think about, oh, Baldur's Gate 3 is just this amazing thing. They should, you know, when are we going to see something else like that? I don't know. When are you going to give people 7 years to develop something so that it feels the way they want it to?
Cool. So let's flip back to the tabletop role-playing game industry. Draw Steel has had plenty of time to make their game.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably going to be good. Daggerheart took its time to make their game. It's good. And it's not a huge company. It's a company. Don't get me wrong. They're like a mid-tier, kind of a powerhouse in some ways company. I think they're still just those folks over there, right? Like Travis Willingham and Sam Riegel, they run the show over at Darrington. It's a difference that you can walk up to your boss or the people that you're working with and be like, what do you think about this, right? Like down the hall in a small business situation. And it is a small business still. Like they're not like a billion-dollar company as far as I know, with like a C-suite, and I'm sure they have a CFO and things like that. They do that. They probably have some sort of org structure and whatnot, but it's still tiny. Like I work for a startup. Yeah. It's not a big company. There's like 100 employees. I see the CFO and the COO all the time walking around in the building, right? They're not, they're not unapproachable human beings. It changes how things work, right? Like there's not a disconnect. You could just talk to each other. And that's what they got over at some of these other places. Like I assume that's how Modiphius operates. I know people that work for places like Ghostfire and things like that, and I know that they can just talk to each other. Like it's not a huge company, and they're not as big as Darrington and Critical Role, because I lump them together, but they have that kind of culture where it's, we got some money and we can be creative and we can take some time to do the thing. And to me, that's the best situation for creative output. And we have more companies like that that exist right now.
It's kind of funny to me too, because I can remember them talking about needing the CEOs to sign off on things for the animated series. When you realize the CEOs both had characters in the campaign that the animated series is based on.
Not just had characters, but voiced them. They were the voice actors.
Yeah, they are definitely in touch with the product that they're putting out. And this is, I mean, okay, I'll be slightly harsh here because I don't have a lot of love for Chris Cox, not based on anything he did, based on the fact that he's a CEO that got a bonus that was more than all the people that they laid off the year that they did the massive layoffs.
Sure.
Not a lot of care for that. But I also don't feel Chris Cox channeling that I worked at WotC, I understand how D&D works in a lot of the things that I've seen happening. I feel a lot more of Chris Cox channeling, I am a CEO that needs to make the board happy. And, you know, the shareholders happy, more so than that guy that remembers what it was like when he was hanging out with people like Chris Perkins and Jeremy Crawford.
I mean, nature of the beast, right? That's unfortunately capitalism. I hate to say it that way.
Yeah.
That's the world that we live in.
Absolutely correct. But I did want to bring this up because it is another bit of news today. Todd Kenrick got laid off by Wizards of the Coast.
Weird, huh? We should talk about this. Like what?
Yeah.
The fact that he got laid off, the fact that we barely know who is like working on D&D these days and what that might mean.
This seems to indicate to me, and this isn't just from this, this is from things that Greg Tito said when he left Wizards of the Coast. It really feels like they do not want the people that work on the games to be personalities that the public knows. They want the brand to be the brand. They don't want the designers to be part of the attraction. I think that probably makes sense from some corporate standpoint, whether it makes any sense at all for brand loyalty, probably not. But, and just in case you don't know, Todd Kenrick is the one that did a lot of the interviews, all the YouTube videos that they would do where they would talk to the designers and explain the process that they went through and what they were thinking when they made this or that book. And there's just a lot of Todd Kenrick joking around with people like Chris Perkins or Jeremy Crawford and just talking back and forth about how much they love the game and what they're, you know, what they're doing and what direction they want to take things in. And I just have a feeling that someone at corporate does not want this to be, actually, to a certain extent, I don't think they want to create another Chris Perkins or Jeremy Crawford that people see as more or less the game.
I get that. I mean, are they going to get rid of Wyatt and Schneider then next?
I don't know. I don't know that it's a matter of get rid of people as much as there's no venue for them to be on camera anymore. They don't do the online, you know, the streaming events anymore. If they aren't putting out their own interviews with people, who is going to put them somewhere and talk to them? Because this isn't like when Chris Perkins was playing Spurt on Critical Role. I don't see them having someone go on to, say, Dimension 20 or Critical Role and playing a character as they are someone that is also part of the game. And this actually started when Perkins and Crawford were still there, because there was a point where they were both very active on social media, and then no one at Wizards was active on social media at all.
They must have got the mum order, don't talk on social media.
I was going to say, from back channel sources, yes, they were literally told they were not allowed to say anything on social media. Like, it, this became a mandate that, no, you're done with social media.
Super, super fun, right?
Yeah, and to tie what I was saying about Greg Tito is the one that did a lot of that coordinating with getting celebrities and streamers and, you know, YouTubers to come in there to have these events that they would then put on TV, and so people can see all these people from different types of influencer life having fun with D&D and interacting with people like Perkins and Crawford and showing people, we are a community of D&D and we all love this and, you know, we all enjoy this together. And at some point they told Greg Tito, this isn't, we don't think it's worth it to do this anymore.
The marketing budget probably didn't like make it worth their time compared to the metrics for what sales could be like seen, and they probably needed to save some money, right? Like, is all that stuff costs money to make. It also goes to my, I was making that point about Blizzard. The reason I was making that point is because they would hire people for cheaper. They would move out veteran designers, and then they would bring in younger people that they could hire for cheaper that wouldn't cost them as much, that were up and comers, because it was the D&D brand. You can go work for D&D. Now, I have no idea if that's like a good thing anymore. It might be. It still might be. It's probably still a great thing for somebody who's still pretty new at this stuff, right?
But I mean, Blizzard is actually a really good comparison, because if you go far enough back, Blizzard was a company that was just a bunch of people that were making things like Warcraft that people loved, and they would wait for their next thing to come out, even if it took them years to put it out.
It's true.
And then as they got purchased by various corporations over the years, things changed a lot.
Yeah, because, you know, you get that, you get people that don't understand it trying to get involved with it, and then their goal is to make money. And that's, you know, that's the world that we live in. I also don't expect that, but if Darrington Press ever, you know, if they, I think this is going to blow up and be amazing for a few years. Like, the Daggerheart thing will, in some ways, I think, feel like the 5e thing did in 2014 for a little while. Maybe not as long as the 5e4 D&D 2014 thing did, but for a year or two. I know there's stuff with the licensing. There's a lot of argument about that, whether it's good or bad, and I see people arguing about it all the time. People that are like lawyers being like, look, man, this license is pretty normal. And then people that are like smaller company, RPG companies being like, we can't write under this thing. They'll just take all of our stuff, which is not exactly the truth. I don't know. It's kind of a mess. I'm no lawyer. All I can tell you is what I've seen and what I've read, and I spent way too much time reading up about it and studying into it, because, you know, me and Jerry want to make stuff for Daggerheart. So it's not as bad as you think it is. It's also not perfect, like most things.
No.
Are.
Yeah.
It could have just been under Creative Commons, but that could have also caused a lot of problems. And I think the SRD that they put out is far more comprehensive in a lot of ways than previous SRDs. And much easier to use. Plus, they're giving us all these tools. Like, man, you can make cards on Demiplane. I don't know. Like, that's pretty neat.
I know. That is amazing. Actually, it is not a Darrington Press thing directly, but Demiplane has done some amazing stuff. Like, right? Everything I've seen them actually get the time to develop has been amazing. the most positive thing I can say about Roll20 right now is that you can use Demiplane character sheets on there now for the games that they actually have character sheets and character builders on for Demiplane.
We have integrated our Demiplane character sheets into Roll20 for our Daggerheart game, and it worked pretty seamlessly. Even my friends who are a little bit Luddite-ish had very little problem with it.
Honestly, I don't know about anything else, because it's actually kind of interesting, because we're talking about Daggerheart on one side, which is something that they are supporting via Demiplane, and then Roll20 also did have a hell of a time rolling out that 2024 character sheet.
Working with Hasbro's heart,
mm-hmm.
from what I can tell, it's been very difficult.
As soon as they said they had official support from WotC to help them work on that character sheet, I know it wasn't for a way longer time before they announced this, but I immediately thought, I don't think they're going to be able to support Tales of the Valiant, because they'll have to recreate all of this mm-hmm. themselves in a way that does not look like they're duplicating this.
Yep.
Because there's no way Hasbro is going to say you can use this for someone else.
I think we've rambled on enough about this stuff. I mean, I could talk about it some more, but we might be just trotting over ground that we've already walked on a few times.
You know, to kind of circle around an ending here, it's fascinating to me every few years who is in that secondary orbit of who's important in RPGs. Because there are still people that will throw Paizo out, and I'm not throwing any shade on Paizo, but they aren't in that second tier the same way that they were before. You have people like Free League and Modiphius that have seriously stepped up into spaces like that.
Man, Free League is the thing, right? Like,
oh yeah.
I mean, Free League, all of those licensed games, the Mortborg stuff, and they just have so much going on. Modiphius mm-hmm. is the same way too, right? I'm with you though too. Like Fate fell out, Evil Hat. They're mm-hmm. still a company. They still make cool stuff, but it's just not the same, right?
Yeah, it's not the 2010s where if you ask somebody to name all these things that Fantasy Flight, they're doing great with all their 40K and Star Wars stuff. Fantasy Flight doesn't make RPGs anymore. I don't even know what Fantasy Flight does make anymore because of everything that's happened with Influencer and Asmodee and everything like that.
Name Arkham and then stop.
Yeah.
I think I couldn't name what else. It's just a mess. Like some of the world politics stuff is making games a mess right now.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and if you want to talk about corporate implosion of a game company, Asmodee, and then Asmodee getting bought by Embracer, perfect example of a few corporate acquisitions just destroying an infrastructure there.
Yep, pretty much. On the bright side, people are still making games. On the bright side, we still get to buy and play games. That'll never go away, I don't think, because the internet exists. Heck, we could just get PDFs of games.
This is true. I'm kind of curious to see if anybody picks up Todd Kenrick and starts, you know, having him do video content for them.
Yeah, I wonder too. I mean, my wonder is like how long is it before Dimension 20 is playing a Daggerheart campaign? That's really where I'm at with that.
It is a fascinating new world, and a lot of it just happened today.
So much. So every episode, we're going to look for something related to D&D or tabletop role-playing games, fantasy tabletop role-playing games that we want to pass along to listeners. It might be products, websites, videos, or podcasts, but it will always be something that we think will enhance your tabletop role-playing game experience. But first, Jared, I invoke you eldritchly.
We have got a Patreon now, so if you'd like to help us do the show and provide some additional content for you, we would love it if you decided to join. We've got our own Discord. We have plenty of supplemental material like spells, magic items, NPC classes from the Heroes of Hovel's Way, and more on its way. That and more is really awesome. So become our patron. We're okay with having more than one patron. It's okay.
Do you like She-Ra or Masters of the Universe? Then stay tuned. You might see something cool in the next month or so. Jared, you got anything?
The thing I was going to bring up is kind of funny because I put this in here before any of this news came up, but I was sharing out the Faster Purple Worm Everybody Dies Volume 1 that is being made by Beetle and Grimm. And this is a collection of low-level adventures where the entire point is you have a low-level party that investigates what's happening and then eventually runs into something too powerful for them to handle and it kills them. That is the entire concept of this. But the reason this is interesting with today is that show was originally going to be on that D&D channel that Hasbro was really promoting that I don't know what happened to. So it is kind of interesting because it kind of ties in with Beetle and Grimm, and I don't know, you know, they are still making stuff for D&D, so it's nothing that they're completely cut off from that, but you can, in an officially licensed anthology, be killed by Strahd, the Zhentarim, Demogorgon, a Dracolich, and you can die in lovely locations like Barovia, Waterdeep, Sharn, Sigil, and the cold depths of Wild Space. I kind of like this concept, at least as long as you're letting your players know what the concept of the adventure is. You don't want them playing those first level characters, having the Dracolich show up, and them thinking that this was going to be a long-term campaign.
Did you ever see an episode of it? Because there was like an episode or two out.
I know they had episodes. Actually, I think they are still producing them themselves.
Oh, good. And, good. Yeah. The show is hilarious. Like, it's just watching people just get murdered in the most entertaining ways possible. It's great. It's like watching a slasher flick with a lot of laughter.
So, yeah, I think it's worth checking out. I kind of want to pick it up. And actually, it is probably one of the most affordable things you can find on the Beetle and Grimm
site. That's probably true. I mean, that is a company that is making prestige products, right?
Oh, yeah. I don't throw any shade on them for what they do. I actually did splurge and get the Curse of Strahd box because I knew I was going to be running this. And I don't want to say how much it was. It wasn't the top level platinum, but it was painful. But it's also extremely neat. I have floor plans for every single level of Castle Ravenloft in tactical scale.
Do you know somebody printed it?
Hmm?
Somebody printed it.
I saw that. Yes.
I don't know where it is offhand. That's not what I was going to talk about. But if you look out on the internet, everybody, there is somebody who printed the entirety of Castle Ravenloft, 3D printed that sucker.
My daughter-in-law is trying to talk my son into printing that.
Really?
After she saw that. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So who's going to paint it then? Not you. you'll lose a bit of your life if you do that. Anyways. For me, I like keeping track of like just the tabletop role-playing game space, right? And one of the ways that I do that is I have a lot of YouTube subscriptions and I have a lot of newsletters that I get that I love to read when they pop up in my email inbox. But the one that I want to highlight right now is Questing Beast. That's Ben Milton. He is the designer of Knave and Knave Second Edition. If you want to get a real good feel for what's going on and what the best stuff is in the OSR in that space, Ben does great reviews of the games. He reads them. He flips through them. He's got a nice camera setup for it. And I just really like his insights. So he's a teacher. So he's an exceptional public speaker anyway. So his ability to present and then review and then show off the cool things about a book that he is taking a look through is top notch. So I highly suggest checking out Questing Beast and giving him a subscribe. Ever watch Questing Beast, Jared?
I have not, but there are many, many things that I should probably watch that I end up rewatching something I've already seen 300 times before because I need background noise while I work on something else.
It's fair. I get that. I totally get that. Well, we are happily part of the Polygamers Podcast Network, helping you run and play your best games. We think you'll enjoy another Polygamers Podcast like
the Gnomecast. Several gnomes from Gnome Stew get together to talk about gaming topics and themselves in an effort to entertain you and avoid being thrown in the stew. I may have been on that recently.
You were, and I was wondering if you guys were going to get thrown in the stew because of the irreverence that you listed out there. Something about kidnapping, something about bribery. I mean, you guys were doing all sorts of underhanded things.
A few felonies, yes.
Just a few. Well, we've used up all of our resources, so I think it's time for a long rest, Jared, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I hope that this adventure was rewarding for you, and we hope that you'll go exploring us when we get to start our next adventure.